Yeah, I'm John. I'm married. I've got four children. The oldest is at university. The youngest is at primary school. But going back a number of years, we used to always have our holidays at Tenby. And there was this morning when we just had two kids. And my wife was having a bit of a rest. And I was having this proud dad moment where I was with the buggy, with the littlest one, Benji, who's now 17, he was asleep in the buggy, and Rebecca was toddling along at the side. And where we're at Tenby, there's a slope down from the high seafront, sort of a zigzag, quite steep, and you go down a ramp, there's a bench, there's a fence, and then there's a cliff face, and then goes down. And I'm going, what a wonderful day this is, it's great. I'm thinking about what ice cream I'm going to have later. And I'm at the top of the ramp, and Rebecca turns to me and says, "Dad, have you seen this flower?" And so I think I put the brake on the buggy. And I turn around to look at Rebecca, and then I look, and the crown of the buggy, with her son asleep inside of it, is hurtling down the ramp. And it was like time slowed down. Like time slowed down. And I ran as fast as I could. And I reached out to grab the buggy. And I couldn't quite get it. And the buggy hit the bench at the bottom. Flipped up. Came back down. I pulled it back. And there's my son saying, "Again." But doesn't life at times, individually, feel as if in the buggy of our lives, the hands are off and we're in free fall? And at our particular moment in history, many of us feel like that, not just as individuals, but as a collective whole. Whether it's civilization and culture, the stability which was there in childhood, or certainly in my childhood, I was brought up in the myth of progress. Things are getting better, and in many ways they were. Globally and individually. First to go to university, that kind of thing. But now it feels as if we're in free fall. War in Europe. Destruction in Gaza. But then the topic of tonight, climate and ecological collapse. From a Christian perspective, it can feel as if perhaps God has taken his hands off the buggy. And we're in free fall. And we're not saying the words again and again. Perhaps we're more echoing the words of Jesus on the cross when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Perhaps that's the reality that we're in. Or we may prefer to be those who are just asleep in the buggy, while in one sense all hell breaks loose. Let me share with you a poem which picks up some of these themes. Do not run from concrete reality into a world of romanticized abstractions. Take courage. The truth at times will hurt. Do not romanticize reality, but look it straight in the eye and behold the nightmarish evil that many endure. Don't dodge or look away, but lament and grieve, the kingdom is calling. Don't dodge or look away, but listen and love, the kingdom is calling. Do not romanticize reality, but look it in the eye and commit yourself to justice and peace. Hold the hand of the hurting. Wrap your arms around the broken. Hold their gaze and whisper, "This is not the way it was meant to be." Speak truth to those corrupted by power. Stand up for the oppressed. Hold their gaze and whisper, this is not the way it is meant to be. Do not romanticize reality, but rest a while in extravagant love. Bathe in his kindness, receive his healing. Do not romanticize reality, but know that hope is on the way, for he will transform reality. There is not a hurt he will not heal. Several years ago, before the onset of COVID-19, my worldview underwent a seismic shift. Immersed in preparations for a sermon series on the book of Revelation, I found myself one Friday amidst a youth-led climate march in Leeds city centre. Now, just to clarify, I wasn't there as a youth. I was there as a supportive father, accompanying my teenage daughter who had skipped school with hundreds of others to raise a voice of protest. And during what was quite a sizable protest, I absorbed a series of talks on climate change delivered by scientists from the University of Leeds. Their revelations shattered my preconceptions. They challenged my narratives. Serving as an apocalypse of the harsh reality, the climate crisis is far more dire than I had ever imagined. I actually knew about global warming. That was part of my sort of comprehensive school education. I can remember even offsetting a few flights, paying that little bit of extra. But I didn't realise how bad it was. And after several weeks of doing my own research into mainstream climate science, I continued to be confronted emotionally by this unsettling truth. I realised that the world I once knew had vanished, replaced by a new reality of climate breakdown. Embracing this apocalyptic awakening, rooted in the Greek word apokalypsis, meaning unveiling, I delved into an in-depth study of the book of Revelation, an apocalyptic text which concludes the Christian canon. Within its pages, I discovered a call to unwavering allegiance to Jesus amidst the world besieged by oppressive forces. Contrary to popular misconceptions propagated by certain Christian media outlets, Revelation isn't a crystal ball predicting contemporary events. Rather, it's a scathing critique of the Roman Empire and its systems of domination. It reveals that the empire, with its insatiable thirst for power and growth, built on slavery and violence, is the harbinger of destruction and desolation, the very antithesis of goodness and justice. All that glitters is not gold, and the Pax Romana, working at behest of evil, is a beast. But Christians are called to follow the way of the butchered lamb who rules and reigns with self-giving, sacrificial love. So I'm reading Revelation in that way, aware of climate breakdown. And it made me think of the unholy trinity of our own day, of consumerism, unrestrained capitalism and individualism. And Revelation, in a sense, gave me, in its metaphorical narratives, a stark warning. They remind us that the illusion of stability offered by these systems is just that, an illusion. The emperor isn't wearing any clothes. In truth, they are the architects. This would be empire in the book of Revelation, but unrestrained capitalism, consumerism and individualism in our own day and age. They are the architects of our planet's demise, promising prosperity but delivering only devastation. These reflections on climate and the book of Revelation went on to be published in a book called Time to Act. So if you're interested in exploring more of that, there's a book called Time to Act. It's in there. But tonight, I have a fourfold task. Firstly, I want to sketch an apocalypse, an unveiling of our current predicament. Secondly, I want to speak to you prophetically. By this, I do not mean that I'll offer predictions of the future, although I will sketch out some trajectories and possible future scenarios. Rather, drawing insights from Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann, I want to articulate truth in a culture of denial. That's what prophets do, articulate truth in a culture of denial. I also want to enact hope in a culture of despair. And I also want to advocate speaking truth to power for the sake of the powerless. What I'm not going to be doing, which is what some churches can be really good at, I'm not going to peddle hopium. You can tell I work with people in addiction, can't you? Yeah? I'm not going to peddle hopium. Hopium is where you give people a shot of hope which distracts them from reality. Instead, I want to speak of hope-filled realism. That which takes the reality that we're in with utter seriousness. Thirdly, alongside this prophetic and apocalyptic task, which helps to see our diagnosis, I want to speak of love. Love is the treatment option for our wounded world. It's an intervention to avoid worst case scenarios and the necessary pastoral posture as humanity lives in and through the time of the great unravelling. It's a love that looks like something, a love that can shape imaginations and possible futures. This love, the human and divine disposition to have affection, is also a verb that can be embraced and enacted to counter the idols of self, consumerism, and unrestrained capitalism. And also, love is that which can comfort those who are wounded by our present predicament. And love for the Christian finds its apex in the God-man Jesus. Love and Jesus will be our compass and guide. And lastly, that's a long intro, this, isn't it? You just realised it. Long intro. We're gonna get there. Lastly, because Duncan's gonna cough loudly when it's time to finish for discussion. After I've spoken prophetically about and mentioned the apocalypse and about love, you're going to be invited to talk and share and question what you have heard. So, fasten your seatbelts. Let's go. Part one, Apocalypse Now. In a recent television broadcast, David Attenborough spoke these words. Right now, we are facing a man-made disaster of a global scale. Our greatest threat in thousands of years, climate change. If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilization and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon. The sobering truth of our times is that we are living amidst the throes of climate breakdown, our very own apocalypse. The culprit behind this crisis, fueled by unrestrained capitalism and consumerism, is none other than the pervasive presence of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, largely stemming from the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. We once turned to fossil fuels as a beacon of progress, a source of blessing that promised us comfort and advancement. Indeed, through their utilisation, our lives have been transformed in a myriad of ways. Fossil fuels. From nourishing our bodies with food, to adorning ourselves with clothing, from traversing great distances through transportation, to harnessing the power of technology for our benefit, fossil fuels have woven themselves into the fabric of our civilization. They have lifted millions out of poverty and have contributed to the rise, until very recently, of global life expectancy. However, the shadow cast by our reliance on fossil fuels grows longer with each passing year. In the blink of a geological eye, spanning a mere 60 years, human activity, especially the consumption of fossil fuels, has inflicted unprecedented damage upon our planet. We stand witness to the dawn of the Anthropocene epoch, a period marked by irreversible alterations to ecosystems and weather patterns. The telltale signs are all around us. Temperatures soaring, seas swelling, oceans acidifying, forests receding, and biodiversity vanishing. Despite our knowledge, global emissions continue to climb unabated. Consider this. The Earth now accumulates at a rate equivalent to 12 Hiroshima bombs detonating every single second. The Earth now accumulates heat at the rate of 12 Hiroshima bombs detonating every single second. Just let that sink in. That's enough energy to boil 700 million kettles per second, with a staggering 90% of that heat being absorbed into our oceans. The first major scientific report warning of global warming came out in 1990. Emissions are 60% higher now, and still rising. In the book of Revelation, the Roman Empire is called the destroyer of the earth. But this label could be given to our generation. We turn to fossil fuels for blessing, but now they bring, and are bringing, a curse upon humanity. This is the story. The apocalypse for those with eyes to see that we find ourselves in. In the opening pages of The Lord of the Rings. When I'm going to say rereading it, I'm actually listening to it on audiobook. It's cheating a bit, isn't it? But we read these words. This is Frodo and Gandalf talking. "I wish it need not have happened in my time," said Frodo. "So do I," said Gandalf. "And so do all who live to see such time. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." A year ago, scientists delivered the unsettling news that global temperatures had soared to 1.2 degrees above that of the pre-industrial era. However, where we are heading is painting an even grimmer picture. A damning UN report recently underscored that there is currently no credible pathway to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Even if nations manage to meet their current targets, and we're not, a staggering 2.4 degree rise in temperature looms ominously by the century's end. The stark reality is that in recent months, daily global temperatures have a number of times gone beyond the 2 degree mark. The month of February alone recorded temperatures of 1.7 degrees above the pre-industrial level. Now, for anyone who's been watching sort of a bit of BBC News when COPs are on, we're all hearing 1.5 is the level.
February came in at 1.7 degrees on average. Now, some of that has to do with the El Nino weather phenomenon that's happening at the minute. Another part of that is we've been greening up global shipping emissions because we're using dirty fuel. But dirty fuel, it can actually help a little bit, because what it does, it sort of gets in the atmosphere and stops the sun rays getting out. So as we start to clean things up, you'll see an uptick in temperatures, which is, some of you might think, hang on, isn't the goal to lower carbon emissions? Yes, but even in doing so, we might see an immediate uptick because it's actually, the atmosphere is, in a sense, cleaner and there's more sun rays getting down. 1.7 degrees Celsius in February. Climate scientists are concerned. This is keeping them awake at night. The prospect of breaching 2 degrees centigrade within a few decades is on the cards. The pace of change far outstrips the projections made by the scientific community just a few years ago. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that humanity faces a direct existential threat. And more recently, Guterres said this: we're on the highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator. It shouldn't take a host of churches together gathering to have a guest speaker to come in and speak with clarity, hopefully clarity, I'm hoping so, a few nods here, about the situation. This should be mainstream news. During COVID, our politicians stood in front of the nation, stood in front of a lectern and addressed the nation about the situation we're in. Why is this not happening? Sorry, that was off notes there. I was getting political, sorry. Okay, Justin Welby, back on track now. Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he said this, and these aren't words typical of an archbishop. He said, the horsemen of the climate apocalypse are at the gates. Well, what are the horsemen of the Anthropocene? According to Gaia Vince, in her excellent book, Nomad Century, the four horsemen are fire, heat, drought, and flood. And they're all sort of interconnected. Each of these horsemen are set to make parts of the world uninhabitable. And each bring distinct but related suffering to human beings. The UN estimates that by 2050, we could see up to 1 billion refugees. That's a different world than we live in now. Even if it's like, it's half that. That's a different world than we live in now. Why? Because due to floods, temperatures, parts of the world are going to become incompatible with human life. Wildfires, first horseman, it destroys communities. Last year, Canada had record-breaking fires with 45.7 million acres going up in flames, an area twice the size of Portugal. In 10 years' time, we'll look back at that figure as being a low end. It will be beaten in the coming years. In 2020, 20% of Australia's forests were destroyed in wildfires. And this summer, our news feeds again will be filled with tourists fleeing fires. Because of the El Nino weather effect and what I've already said about temperatures, this summer is going to be particularly, and maybe the next summer after, particularly bad. Then it might drop a little bit, but we're still on this trajectory of temperatures going up. Second horseman, heat is making our summers hotter. And for many of us, a heat wave may be nice, but we don't have the infrastructure, even here in the UK, to be prepared for the temperature rises that are coming. There were 62,000 heat-related deaths in Europe in 2022. In other parts of the world, temperatures are now becoming incompatible with human life. Like COVID and the cost of living crisis, it's the most vulnerable who suffer the worst effects of rising temperatures. So generally, it's those who are elderly or frail or have physical health conditions who end up in hospital or die when the heat wave. But there's now something called hot bulb temperatures. A few years ago, scientists were predicting that we might see this in decades' time. And yet, we're already witnessing now hot bulb temperatures. And what does that mean? Well, in places like Pakistan, India, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, and Australia, hot bulb temperatures, which are not just to do with heat, it's also to do with humidity at the same time, they don't just affect the physically vulnerable or fragile. Instead, healthy young people wearing light clothes with access to water, sitting in the shade and with a fan in front of them can become hospitalised or die. And this is something we thought was in decades' time. Drought. Third horseman. Climate change is bringing doubt to some of the world's poorest. 150 million people in East Africa are affected by drought, with 20 million facing food insecurity and malnutrition. Last horseman. Flood. Floods. Extreme rainfall produces catastrophic floods. Storm Daniel hit Libya last year. And alongside having the misuse of resources in that nation and not investing in infrastructure, so I'm not putting it solely on the storm. Thousands were washed away when two dams burst. Sea level rise, also a type of flood. Coastal cities, they're going to be challenged, and there's going to be a bit of a climate apartheid going on. There's some cities and some areas where they have the money and the finances to build the bigger walls. And there's other places, like Bangladesh, which just won't be able to do that. Barbadian Prime Minister Maya Motley made this dire warning. 1.5 is what we need to stay alive. 2 degrees is a death sentence for the people of Antigua and Barbuda, for the people of the Maldives, for the people of the Dominica and Fiji, for the people of Kenya and Mozambique, and yes, for the people of Samoa and Barbados. Low-lying nations are going to simply cease to exist. I can't see how that is not already locked in. Whatever we do. At times, the reality of climate breakdown presses into the present, flooding us with feelings of anxiety and grief. What you're perhaps feeling now is perfectly natural, a human response to what you're hearing. We can feel overwhelmed in the face of systems and structures of domination that seem hell-bent on pushing us to a point of no return. And sadly, there is a point of no return. I'm just going to pause away from the notes. I feel in one sense I'm overemphasising this, but I actually think we have an incorrect narrative that's out there. We don't realise how bad it is. And I'm aware that this is causing, it can cause hurt and upset, and some of us might be laid awake at night thinking about it. And in one sense, I'm sorry for that and also not sorry. I want to take the opportunity to speak prophetically and to speak truth in a culture of denial. Not that I imagine anyone's coming here thinking I deny climate change, but there can be a type of soft denial where we won't see how bad it is, partly protect ourselves and our emotions. So we feel overwhelmed in the face of systems and structures of domination that seem hell-bent on pushing us to the point of no return. And sadly, there is a point of no return. There are tipping points, positive feedback loops, which if activated, mean that even if we cease using fossil fuels, the temperatures will continue to rise. Let me mention just two of these. And you've probably heard of these before. Sea ice and melting permafrost. Sea ice has a high albedo. It's very white and reflective. I mean, you probably knew it was white, but anyway. Yeah, it's white and reflective. And it reflects back solar energy. More solar energy than the dark sea. But when the global temperatures rise, more sea ice melts in summer, which means that the sea surface is more darker and therefore more heat is being absorbed into the ocean other than being reflected back. But then that raises temperatures, which means more ice melts. Let's take permafrost. Did you know that 11% of the global surface is underlain by permafrost? And what is permafrost? It's supposed to be permanently frozen soil, rocks and sand, you know, kept together by ice. And they contain twice as much carbon, that 11% of the land surface permafrost, twice as much carbon as the atmosphere and three times as much carbon as that stored in the world's forests. This is carbon, which is locked in, mainly CO2 and methane. But due to rising temperatures, permafrost is beginning to melt and thaw. And when it melts, it releases CO2 and methane into the atmosphere. This in turn means higher temperatures and more permafrost will melt. Can you see how that's a positive feedback loop? Now, why am I, in a sense, milking some of this climate science? And it's probably stuff you know, but why am I? Well, I think we need to be clear in the story we tell. It is simply not true. It's counterfactual to say that we need to act now to avoid dangerous levels of climate change. It's not true. And in churches, I think actually that's one of the messages that we have, and that's out there. If we act now, we can avoid catastrophe. We cannot avoid catastrophe. We are in catastrophe. The question for our future is not if we will avoid catastrophic effects, it's to what level. To what level? We need to choose the best. It sounds strange. We need to choose the best catastrophe. An apocalypse. Given this, let me mention now four possible futures. I've got three of these from Rupert Reed. And one of them I've got from Christian theology, and I'll give you that one first. So these are four possible futures. You probably guess this is Christian theology one. The return of Jesus. Yeah, possible future. Don't know when, but for Christians, there's there as a thing. But let me go through the other three. The first one, possible future. And by here, possible future, I'm talking perhaps within the lifetimes of some in this room, within the lifetime of children and grandchildren, possible futures. perhaps even a, yeah. The first one is the dodo. Oh, we don't like the sound of that. Correct, we don't. As Pope Francis says, doomsday predictions can no longer be met with irony or disdain. The dodo scenario is this civilization could utterly and terminally, as a result of climactic instability, bring irreversible, catastrophic damage to the ecosystems. So this is a future where we'll see societal breakdown and the collapse of civilization. The future of mass starvation, mass migration, where we move into a hot house earth situation. So this isn't where the future says that 2.0, we're hitting these tipping points and it's just runaway climate change. In the dodo scenario, humanity will fail to slam on the brakes and we enter into a hot house earth situation in which the vast amount of humanity, along with entire ecosystems, becomes extinct. In this scenario, we built Babel with the tools of unrestrained capitalism and consumerism. We turned to it for blessing. We thought we were gods. We thought we were exceptional as mammals. But we opened the door to ecological violence and it has overwhelmed us. In this scenario, reflecting the language of the Book of Revelation, we become destroyers of the earth and ourselves. This scenario will more or less be guaranteed if we remain addicted to fossil fuels. Although the framing of it is like the dodo, and like maybe speaking a bit dramatically, this is actually rooted in like mainstream science. I'm not saying we're going the dodo, but I'm saying if we continue to be addicted to fossil fuels, we will go, unless Christ returns, the way of the dodo. The second one, and give us a smile if you like this, the butterfly. That's far better than the dodo, isn't it? The butterfly. This is the view that civilization will somehow manage to transform itself deliberately, radically, and rapidly in an unprecedented manner in time to avert collapse. That last sentence was actually a quote from Rupert Breed. I'll say it again. This is the view that civilization in the butterfly scenario will somehow manage to transform itself deliberately, radically, and rapidly in an unprecedented manner in time to avert collapse. This would mean we would need a new global political and economic ideology. It would mean immediate and deep cuts to fossil fuels emissions. And it would involve the development of carbon reduction technology. In the butterfly scenario, we transform and transition rapidly from fossil fuel capitalism to avert mass suffering and societal collapse. The governments of the world, including India and China, achieve the almost impossible by reducing emissions to almost zero by 2030. That's 2030 for the developed world and 2040 for the developing world. Although some traction is given to this approach by IPCC and others, it is almost, as I see it, entirely dependent on three factors. So these are the three factors, as I've heard about this butterfly, and I want the butterfly, but it's dependent on three factors. Number one, the development of a new global political ideology, a waking up of the governance of the world with the political will and structures to bring change. It requires a fundamental re-evaluation of economic assumptions around growth, value and progress. The second thing for the butterfly that would be needed would be immediate and significant cuts to carbon emissions. To quote from lead climate scientist Kevin Anderson, "For a fair chance of staying below 2 degrees, developed countries, including the UK, must bring about immediate and deep cuts in emissions from all sectors." What would that look like? Well, it would look like cuts of 10 to 15% year on year with immediate effect. Kevin Anderson then says, this is starting now, not 10 years from now. And as you listen to this, you might be thinking, hang on, I like the sound of butterfly, but actually, here's the third thing. It would require the development of scientific and technological solutions, which include carbon capture and removal technology, getting emissions and putting them into the ground. This is a technology which is not available to us at present in terms of scale. So for us to get the butterfly, we need technology which we currently don't have or know how to get. Geoengineering is another option which is being explored. But this brings with it huge risks as we manipulate weather systems, where we'll bring benefits to some parts of the globe, but unintentionally or even intentionally bring havoc elsewhere. The butterfly is, we'll all agree, the preferred scenario. So you've got the dodo, the butterfly, the return of Jesus, Christian theological option. The other one is the phoenix. The phoenix is the view that this civilization will collapse, unable to bear the weight of that which is placed upon it. It'll be a time of unprecedented suffering, the collapse of global infrastructure. It includes major food shortages. But as this civilization collapses, it will manage to seed a future successor civilization. The phoenix being that bird of Greek mythology, features in Harry Potter, doesn't it? It's the bird that dies and out of the ashes, something rises. The dodo, the butterfly, the phoenix, the return of Jesus. If at the end, and during questions, you've got another scenario, obviously this is broad stroke, let me know. We're going to transition to part two about love. We're going to get the questions, don't we? Everyone okay so far? Well, not okay. I'm talking about pretty awful stuff. Is everyone tracking so far? Let me give you a poem which reflects some of these thoughts. I can't stop climate breakdown, but I can play my part. A small part, so small that it is insignificant, but I will try. I can't stop climate breakdown, but I can pray. An act so small that it seems insignificant, but I will try. I can't stop climate breakdown, but I can love and be loved. So beautiful that my life has dignity, but I will try. I can't stop climate breakdown, but I can rage against the machine and say not in my name. So small, but I will try. I can't stop climate breakdown, but I can hope and dream and participate in a conspiracy of compassion, a holy rebellion, until that day when all tears are wiped away. And many of us might experience missional paralysis. Like rabbits caught beneath the headlights, we do not know what to do, so we don't do anything. Or to change the metaphor, we may choose to act like ostriches that bury our heads in the sands, even though the tide is coming in. In our world of climate breakdown, like COVID, we can look to leaders, global, national, local, to lead us through the crisis. Yet when we look for effective leadership, we can too often become disheartened, disappointed, and discouraged. What kind of leaders do we need at this late hour? How should the church respond? What implications does this have for our own lives of mission and discipleship? So how should we live? I want to suggest that we need to take up afresh the path of love. Take a breath. Undo your seatbelt. Part two. Seatbelt on. Love in a world of climate breakdown. It's a shorter part. Don't move, Duncan. Jesus said this. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind and soul. And love your neighbour as yourself. There is no greater commandment than these. Jesus is clear. Our lives are to have vertical and horizontal dimensions. We are to love God with our heart, mind and soul. And love our neighbours. A love for neighbours. Our near neighbours. Those in our cities. Those in our parishes. Those in our communities. If the days ahead are to be difficult, then our churches would do well to be loving and resilient communities. One of the ways we can show love in a time of climate breakdown, and we can all do this. So you ready? This is something we can all do. Glue our... No, not really. We can do this. Talk. Catherine Hayhoe, both a Christian and leading climate scientist, says that talking is the most important thing we can do. Talk, chat, and share with others. We need to talk with our friends, our family, our neighbours, our work colleagues, and others about the climate. If we talk about it, it prevents us from slipping back into functional denial. Talk stirs imaginations, and if we can't imagine a better future, we're never going to put in place what we need to get there. Talk leads to action at both an individual and community level. This in turn influences the political and economic will of the city and the nation. So be talking about, talk about this talk with people over a cuppa. Because sometimes, like, I found when I give these kind of talks, people like know it in, but they've never quite articulated it. Does that make sense to anyone? Love for neighbours, so near neighbours, having a chat, but also our global neighbours, including our brothers and sisters who live in distant lands. A love for the poorest in the world, for those who have contributed to the least in the rise in global temperatures, but suffer the worst of the consequences. Let me spell this out. The richest 1% of people in the world produce twice as much emissions as the poorest 3.8 billion. To love in a world of climate breakdown may require us to live more simply so that others may be allowed to simply live. What does it mean for the church in the developed world to embody the self-giving, sacrificial love of Jesus in our lifestyles? There is a limited carbon budget which keeps us from 2 degrees. Should this budget be used in building resilience in poorer countries, developing healthcare and local food infrastructure, or should this carbon budget be spent on high carbon consumerist lifestyles? We need to think Christianly about a whole host of things. Flying for pleasure. Our consumption of meat. By the way, I like flying. I'm not doing it at the minute, and I like meat as well. But these are the questions we need to ask. Questions about the fashion industry. Our desire for endless economic growth, our relationship to consumerism. And perhaps, although this probably isn't what Jesus is referring to, we should include a love for future generations. What we do in the next few years will determine the level of suffering which will be faced by future generations. Sir David King, Cambridge University and former advisor to the Blair and Brown governments, he said this: we have to move rapidly. What we do over the next 3 to 4 years, I believe, is going to determine the future of humanity. We are in a very desperate situation. Our generation, stands at the hinge of history. In that if we do not embed the radical systemic changes that are necessary, then our children and grandchildren will face hardships that are barely imaginable for us. And we all know that recycling, eating less meat and flying less help to lower carbon emissions. And if you're doing that, great, continue. I'm not knocking that, as I've already said. And if you haven't considered, do consider all these things. But the stark reality is that they're not enough. They're not enough if we are seeking to avert the worst of what may be. They're not enough if we want to avoid the worst kind of catastrophe for future generations. What we need is systemic change. Our political leaders and economic systems have failed us. I don't know how we can say anything otherwise, given where we are at. They have failed us. And what does it mean for us to take up the way of Christ and offer truth and challenge to those who lead us into a tragic future? And Jesus, he practices what he preaches. Love the Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, love your neighbour as yourself. He practices what he preaches. Oh, it'd be great if the church did that, wouldn't it? He practices what he preached. He loves his Father and he embodies and acts this love time and time again. You see, love looks like something. Love is a verb. Love is actualized and embodied in action. So, fear not, I think I'm on my last page. We have time for discussion. Let's just dig a little bit deeper into what it means to love. Martin Luther King said this, justice, it's a great quote this, and you should see what Cornel West does with this quote in a moment, but that, I'm spoiling what's coming. But Martin Luther King said this, justice is what love looks like in public. It's brilliant, that, isn't it? Justice is what love looks like in public. Justice is the dream of the prophets, which stirs imagination so that a new world becomes possible. It is the hope of Amos that looks forward to a time when justice will roll on like a river. Justice is also at the heart of God, as Isaiah says, for the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are those who wait for him. To be a friend of God is to do justice. In Jesus, the Word made flesh, we see justice embodied and entwined with extravagant mercy. He welcomes the weak. He gathers the oppressed. And he lays down the prophetic challenge to the unjust structures and systems of his day. Justice is the setting of the world to rights. Justice stands against oppression, domination, and exploitation. And justice stands with the poor and the powerless and speaks out for those without a voice. And so we see in Jesus' final week that he engages in a symbolic action which causes disruption. He breaks the law. He overturns table. It's a non-violent direct action. It's civil disobedience. In flipping the tables and driving out the money changers, Jesus quotes from prophetic justice passages. Jesus is concerned about justice. In our own time of climate breakdown, standing at the hinge of history, we are called as God's servants, as his church, to be the justice-shaped people of God. As Martin Luther King puts it, a church that has lost its voice for justice is a church that has lost its relevance for the world. Or, more positively, we may say that justice is in our missional DNA. Brothers and sisters, we are called to be a prophetic community who do not retreat into a world of spiritual romanticized abstraction, but to embody the justice-shaped kingdom in speaking out and speaking forth on the issues of the day. We need, here in Horsforth, across West Yorkshire and the UK, to be those who are willing to take justice into the ballot boxes, onto the streets. We need to be those who raise our voices above the parapet of indifference. And perhaps, with love and justice in mind, we need to reconsider our stance towards the democratic right to civil disobedience and non-violent protest. If our leaders continue to deny reality and plunge us further towards mass suffering. Well, that was a controversial last few sentences, wasn't it? Duncan, you can strike that from the recording, that last two sentences, but it's there. Well, Martin Luther King said, justice is what love looks like in public. Cornel West, not to be confused with Kanye, probably wrong audience for Kanye West, really, isn't it? Rocky, you know who Kanye West is? What? Is he? Anyway, Cornel West, he takes up Martin Luther King's quote, justice is what love looks like in public. And he adds this line, justice is what love looks like in public and tenderness is what love looks like in private. Isn't that beautiful? Jesus is tender and kind towards those on the margins. To the poor and the downtrodden, to those suffering. In a world marked by exclusion, Jesus embraced the leper, the weak, the outcast, the marginalised. Jesus listened and loved those who didn't have a voice. He was moved with compassion and tender kindness, and in tender kindness brought hospitality and healing to those pushed towards the edges. As we move further into climate breakdown, let the church be known for its compassion. It's kindness. It's tenderness. There's already a mental health crisis amongst young people. I can't see how that is going to get any better at all. When people realise that the opportunities which they hoped they would have are no longer there. I was brought up in the myth of progress. Young people today are brought up with despair. With despair, what does it mean for us to be tender and kind and loving? Whether we're going the butterfly, whether we're going the phoenix, or whether we're going the dodo. If we are in the time of the great dying, what does it look like to die with kindness and compassion and love? Now, I'm not saying we are, but I am saying that's one possible scenario if we keep pumping out the fossil fuels. What does it mean for us to be tender and kind towards refugees? Let me quote with end with a quote from pastor theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a prophet in his own right, who lost his life for speaking truth in a church which was in denial. He said this: we are not to simply bandage the wounds of victims caught beneath the wheels of injustice. We are to drive a spoke into the wheel itself.